I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Today, we continue our conversations with Henri Mohammed of the Mohammed School of Music, who was gracious enough to visit us twice recently for lengthy conversations. One of those interviews aired during our week of reflections on 514. Today, we will hear the other. We'd like to note that some of the subjects may have been examined in both conversations, including a look at the 25th anniversary of the Mohammed School of Music. Nonetheless, Henri Mohammed's expertise and experience are well worth sharing. And we thank you for listening to What's Next.
So take us back to the origins of starting up a music school in Buffalo.
What drove
you to do that?
So Buffalo's my hometown, born and raised. And in high school, I would perform and do as much as I could with my instrument throughout the area, throughout all of Western New York. And then went to University of Rochester for my bachelor's degree, major in music. And then that fall, I came home. The way the story goes is my younger sister, we all played music. My younger sister, my brother, and my father, at the head of all of it, were all musicians.
Were they all violinists?
My younger brother and I, we both started violin.
Okay.
He was 5, I was 7. My sister, piano and flute. And then my dad is a guitarist and vocalist. And we, as a family ensemble, performed and traveled around, did everything from church every week on Sunday to weddings, birthday parties, festivals. And around the time when I had graduated from college, my sister was a senior at Performing Arts Academy, and she needed some help doing her college audition tapes. You could do the write in performing arts at that time. So
okay.
I went to the school and I helped her out. And it was around that time that I reconnected with one of my teachers from performing arts, the late L. Jared, who, an outstanding musician, teacher of mine, very well known throughout the community. When he heard that I was in Buffalo, he said, "You have to teach, right? You have to share this gift, right? And so I met with him, and that afternoon, I think the next week, I was teaching in Buffalo Public Schools. Actually, my first position was at Waterfront School, right around the corner from here. But along the way, teaching, but going out into the community of Buffalo and reconnecting and performing in churches in this area, I would run into people who would ask me about teaching their child. And I started off with just a couple, private students in my living room and whatnot. And as that amount began to increase, and people that came on board to help, kind of organize what was the formation stages of a school. And then by that summer, we held our first official class as Mohammed School of Music. And it started off with 10 students in 1999. And now, going on, here we are 25 years later. I mean, I don't know how many thousands of students have come through the doors of Mohammed School of Music, as well as the numerous schools in Buffalo Public Schools that I've taught violin programs. I actually counted them up, and there's over 25 schools that I've taught violin in throughout the Buffalo Public School District.
And you're making it sound like you're an old man. You're pretty young.
I'm trying to stay young, but it's been a tremendous journey and so many experiences and of course, students and families and performing opportunities that we've had. And I intend to keep on going for the next 25 and, see what happens then. So
you're constantly studying the violin, not only teaching it, but are you constantly working on your craft?
Oh, yes. Even in this stage, I have a coach, an outstanding coach named Dr. Kelly Hall Tompkins, who's one of the greatest violinists in the world right now. She on the faculty of Manhattan School of Music in New York City, and when I was at Eastman doing my undergraduate, she was in the graduate program.
All right.
So we kind of actually, I don't want to say we kind of grew up together, but we performed in festival orchestras together at Eastman. And so she's based out of New York City. She's Grammy nominated. She was the first violin concertmaster of the Fiddler on the Roof production on Broadway. And they made a recording of that, and she is the Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, right? Wow.
And as I'm speaking, she's now on tour in Spain. She was commissioned to premiere a new violin concerto by Jeff Beal. So she's in Spain performing that with Maestro Leonard Slatkin in Spain. And she's my coach, you know.
And I'm interested about that because here you are. You're an accomplished individual. You've been doing this for a long time. You've played with the BPO. You've played all over the place. Yet there's somebody, I guess, I hate to use the word above you, but if there's right. somebody there who's saying, you did that wrong? I mean, is that really that specific, that critical?
Absolutely. You know, every opportunity that I have to further go deeper into my study, I think about it in terms of martial arts, you know, form we study, there's always, you know, someone that's like the grand master, right? But even the grand master will say that there's still perfecting the art, right?
Yeah.
They're still looking for the next step and a better way to execute. That's how it is for me. You know, I said for this Beethoven violin concerto, I wanted to study it in a new way. You know, and Dr. Kelly has shown me things on the concerto that I've never looked at before. And I'm sure, you know, studying a piece like Beethoven, which I could talk about Beethoven for hours, his music is so intricate and so in-depth that I'll study it this time. And then when the next time I go back to it, it'll be like starting all over again.
Really?
And that's the beauty of the music of Ludwig von Beethoven, and in particular, his Beethoven violin concerto.
Is there a spirit inside that concerto that you connect with, or the, some of the, I guess, meaning or whatever?
Yes, there is. I fell in love with that concerto in college, and there's so many aspects of Beethoven's life that I've connected with. And so, of course, his handicap. He's the composer that lost his hearing. But miraculously, and for musicians, you know, those of us that play instruments, any genre, but in particular classical music, and for him to be able to write music so technically challenging, so complicated, but never hear the notes, you know, and to have it come out, turn out to be a masterpiece, unprecedented, unmatched, that we're still playing 200 years later. He was an absolute divinely gifted man, you know.
And I'm wondering about that. Like you said, he couldn't hear it, but he did it. And obviously, it's a great piece of music, one of the greatest of all time, to say
absolutely,
the least.
Yes.
Have you ever tried to put yourself in his shoes, how he went about doing
that? I've studied his life. I read his works and accounts. And one writing that I read in my scholarship was that he had the ability to see and hear the notes, both see and hear the notes. And so he wrote in one article that I read that he would see the notes in the atmosphere. And then he said the only thing he would have to do was write the notes down. I'm sure there's a little more to it.
Right.
Because what he wrote, you know, this Beethoven violin concerto was deemed so technically difficult that no one performed it for 50 years.
Wow.
And long after he had passed away, then they dug it up again. Someone said, I want to give it a try. And even today, you know, even some of the greatest violinists, you know, that piece can be a stumbling block, you know, because of the technicality of the beauty of it, even its simplicity, you know. It's just a masterpiece that violinists will spend the rest of our lives just trying to master just that one piece.
I know this is, you know, obviously difficult to just describe on radio, but I'm wondering, like, when you say the technical elements and the challenge of it, I mean, is it the fingers, or is it the bow? I mean, what's going on that makes it so challenging?
What I experience is, yes, there are the notes, playing the notes, articulating the notes, but there's kind of an undercurrent to the piece. And that undercurrent is the spirit of Beethoven. It's what he experienced when he wrote the piece. And so there's a mystery in Beethoven's life. There was a love that he had that he only referred to as his immortal beloved. And this mysterious woman that was in Beethoven's life at the time when he was coming to grips with the loss of his hearing, and like any athlete, musician, you know, that could be a career-ending injury. And Beethoven even contemplated suicide. And so his immortal beloved comes into his life, at his lowest point, and it's at his lowest point that he begins to write some of his most transformative music, like his Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, dun, 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 dun. And of course, this Beethoven Violin Concerto, and then leading on through up to his Ninth Symphony. But when I interpret the piece, I hear her presence in that piece. I really? Hear the impact of her in the piece. I experience the notes from that perspective. Beethoven also was of African descent. Another one was the violinist Le Chevalier de Saint George, who they just made a movie about. Hmm. Even though we could perform in what they called higher, you know, societies, but the dilemma was we weren't able to produce families and children and marriage. And so Beethoven and his immortal beloved actually was a secret relationship that eventually was not able to be fulfilled. They didn't have any children. They weren't able to get married. So that dilemma, that controversy is in the piece as well. So when I play the piece, yeah. I can hear those passages. I can feel that dilemma. I can feel that sorrow because Beethoven, you know, died unmarried without children. And so that pain is in the piece as well. So going back to being able to perform the piece,
right.
You know, yes, there's the technical aspects of the piece and there are some technically challenging passages, right? But the emotional depth of the piece, you know, is what we have to put into it to make Beethoven's spirit live in the piece. And also the piece really is close to 50 minutes long. So here is, you know, the violin solo in front of the orchestra from memory playing, you know, close to 50 minutes of music. And that's physically draining.
I can only
right?
imagine. Yeah.
And so there's a lot that goes into preparing that piece. And, you know, sometimes I kind of liken it to like a boxer preparing for the main event. Of course, I'm eating a healthy diet. I exercise every day. And of course, I practice hours a day. I study, I read, I research Beethoven. I study with my coach. I listen to articles. I listen to talks on Beethoven's music. Everything I can put into it to make the piece live.
Wow. That's amazing. Henry Muhammad with us here on What's Next, talking about his 25th anniversary of his Muhammad School of Music here in Buffalo, but so much more. I'm really appreciating the depth of this conversation. Just to get back to that, like you said, that performance. So there it is. It's 50 minutes and it's physically draining.
Yes,
but you say you want to stay connected with, I guess, for lack of a better term, the emotion that's coming out of the music as well. That's got to be its own kind of challenge. I mean, like you have to be in some sort of zone I think few people could really experience.
Yes. You know, I read a book titled The Violin, A Social History of the World's Most Versatile Instrument. It was published in 2012. The author is Robert Schoenbaum. Hmm. I think I said his name right. And it's an 800-page book on the history of the violin. But there's a particular section where he talks about the Beethoven Violin Concerto. And he says that Beethoven in his music, I'm just kind of all quoting because I don't have the direct quote in front of me.
That's
but
fine. Yes.
He said that where other composers were writing music for the weekend, Beethoven was writing for eternity. He said that Beethoven's music in one swoop became art, you know, whereas the crucifix was to the church, Beethoven's music was to concert halls.
Mm.
So Beethoven, you know, when I approach Beethoven, you know, not that there's anything less with Mozart or Haydn. I love Mozart and Haydn. I love Bach. But Beethoven, when I approach Beethoven for me is music that represents a masterpiece that is etched in artistic history. And so as an artist interpreting his work, you know, for me, it becomes more than just the notes. Of course, I practice the notes. I have to have the notes under my fingers. I have to have the technicalities there because that alone can, you know, can sink the ship. But once I get past that, now I can get into the artistic creation of painting the colors from a visual art perspective, painting the colors that I want the audience to experience, that I want to experience, listening to the orchestra and then feeding back and forth between the orchestral parts. And also at the same time, creating something, you know, new that is my unique interpretation that hopefully Beethoven will listen in and say, you know, I'm pleased with this recording. Mm. You know, so it becomes a tremendous exercise. And, you know, as I'm talking about the Beethoven Violin Concerto, and I performed other concertos. I performed Tchaikovsky, I performed Brahms, Mozart, all of them, Bach. But Beethoven, you know, if there were a ranking, you know, heavyweight champion, I think Beethoven Violin Concerto takes all the elements of the other composers' concertos and puts them into one package where you have to have technicality, you have to have artistry, you have to have stamina, you know, and you have to have musicianship. All that comes together, and it is truly a masterpiece concerto. I've played it, performed it several times with orchestra, and this will be the next time, and then hopefully the next time I approach it again, it'll be a new experience for me, you know?
So now, when you're doing the concerto, you've created, and I must admit, I'm wading into very deep waters here that I am not equipped to swim through, but you created original cadenzas. So explain what that means.
Yes. So there's a part of the concerto, you know, most of it, all of it is really notes written out on the score. And, you know, the conductor has his score, the first violins have their score, the, you know, the wind section, the violin solos. And as long as all of us read the score and stay on beat, the music fits together. There's a section of the piece where the orchestra stops and the violin solos or piano solos or flute, whatever instrument is doing the solo, has an opportunity to play a virtuosic display of their ability based on the structure of the piece, based on the ideas and the themes of the piece. Most times, you know, sometimes composers actually write out the cadenza that they want to hear. Of course, this happens in the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. There's a cadenza, and Tchaikovsky wrote it. He said, this is what I want you to play for the cadenza. But other times, the composer leaves it up to the soloist. And I know for Beethoven was known for his ability at improvisation. That was one of his his skills. In fact, I want to get back to the cadenza, but you know, a few years ago during the pandemic, on social media, there was this thing called verses, right? And verses was when, let's say, two rappers would come together and they would try to out-rap each other, right? And that's something that's been going on for many years, and it even dates back to even Beethoven's day. So in Beethoven's day, their version of verses was they would have Beethoven and maybe a new pianist or artist, and the aristocracy would sponsor Beethoven, almost like a duel. It would be a duel. And they would go to, you know, somebody's palace or whatever, and they would place bets on Beethoven, place bets on whoever the other guy was, and they would try to outplay each other. And Beethoven, what he would do is he would, you know, of course, the other guy would go first, like the contender, right? He would play his latest composition, right? And then Beethoven would come along, and he would take maybe the main theme of that piece, right? And kind of tinker it out, right? Little, you know, one finger
on the
tinkering,
fly.
Right.
Okay.
And then he would improvise. And totally, completely turn the piece inside out, upside down, almost making a mockery of the other person. And Beethoven, his ability to improvise was what he was most noted for. So the cadenza of his concertos, sometimes he would leave that open. And because I grew up studying, of course, classical music, but I also study jazz. I play jazz when I have an opportunity. I've done jazz recordings. I'm a little experienced in improvisation as well.
All right.
And so on that opening spot that Beethoven wrote into the concerto, which is called the cadenza, I said, I want to write my own cadenza. I want to improvise my own cadenza.
Mm.
And so I began doing that with several concertos where the cadenza is open for the artist. And it's a lot of fun. It gives me the opportunity to create something really virtually completely new on the spot, you know, depending on what I'm hearing, feeling, experiencing in that moment. So it's definitely a fun part of the piece. And it also is what Beethoven would have done himself had he been at the piano or performing the concerto live. He would have improvised his cadenzas during that part, right?
You know, there's so much of this, and I could probably keep on going on about Beethoven for a while, but I want to get to some other elements of your story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in what it's like for a 7-year-old growing up in Buffalo with a violin, and now in his kids have lots of interests, and most of them don't have an interest in classical music over the violin. And let's be honest, the violin's a difficult instrument to try to master. What was that like for you? I mean, it sounded like your family, there's a core there, right? So obviously at home it was like that, but you know, what was that like?
You know, I was 7, my younger brother was 5, and I remember one day my mother, my father, particularly my father, who was the impetus for the violin. They took us to our first violin lesson.
Hmm.
And I I knew that I wanted to learn a musical instrument. We started with the violin, but it was my parents who really kept me and us focused. As I shared, I studied from 7 all the way right. through college. My brother went into law enforcement, and my sister, who played piano, is a speech pathologist, but she still plays. My brother still plays a little bit, right? But I really fell in love with the instrument, you know? Yeah. And, you know, growing up as a young Black, you know, boy on violin, right. and I don't think I ever saw another Black man playing the instrument. I remember one time on The Cosby Show, Bill Cosby had a segment where he featured the Anderson String Quartet, which is a string quartet for players of all Black women.
Okay.
And that, I was blown away by that. I thought that was, I'd never seen anything like that before in my life.
All right.
You know, as I would perform and, you know, as I increased in technicality and ability, I would audition. I would get into orchestras. There's an orchestra, a countywide orchestra that students audition for, and I got in. And when I would play in these orchestras, I was the only Black person in the entire orchestra on any instrument. For a while, I played in high school. I played in something called the Greater Buffalo Youth Orchestra. I was the only Black person in that orchestra. And even in college at University of Rochester, our University of Rochester orchestras, I played in a couple of those orchestras. I was the only Black person, right? So, you know, it showed me, you know, part of the impetus of starting Muhammad's Music was that it showed me that there's a need for more representation of Black people in classical music in orchestras. I did a presentation back in February for the Urban Education Forum, and I quoted something from the New York Times, an article that they had last year where they mentioned that 2% of American, less than 2% of American orchestras have a Black or a Latino orchestral member.
Wow.
And in Buffalo, I don't think we have any Black or Latino members in the orchestra on any instrument. And so it gives me, you know, an aim, an objective, you know, not just to send students into orchestras, but to increase the visibility of Black people in classical music. In college, I encountered something called the Gateways African American Classical Music Festival.
Hmm.
And the way the story goes is, when I was 16, still here in Buffalo, I was learning the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, which is, you know, an outstanding piece. I mean, it's another staple of violin concerto literature. If you're a violinist and you want to become a professional, you're going to learn the Mendelssohn Violin okay. Concerto, right? And at the time, as I'm sharing, I didn't really have encounters with other Black classical musicians who were peers, but even in a professional setting. And one night I was watching public access television, and as I'm doing some channel surfing, and then I see an image. I see a Black man playing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto with orchestra, a Black conductor, a Black orchestra. And that man who would become my mentor was Minister Louis Farrakhan. So people think Farrakhan, they think the Million Man March.
I went
to the Million Man March. They think, you know, maybe some of the controversy that surrounds him. They think of some of the good that he's done throughout the Black communities of America. But I know him as a professional classical violinist, right?
Wow.
And so that image, you know, of someone playing the same concerto that I was learning, Mendelssohn, and now someone's on the stage that looks like me playing it with an orchestra and a conductor and a Black orchestra, it was like love at first sight. So that when he performed that piece, he first performed it as part of something called the Gateways African American Classical Music Festival. And so a few years later, I go to Rochester, and lo and behold, the Gateways Music Festival is now in residency at Eastman School of Music.
Oh.
So now I have the opportunity to be a part of an organization of it's not just a weekend festival, but it's a year-long initiative in Rochester, where I'm not just going into the community to perform and represent Black classical musicians, but there's also a festival every other year. Over 100 Black classical musicians like me from all over the country, we would come together at Eastman, on the stage at Eastman Theater, and we performed symphonies, everything from Tchaikovsky 4, 5, and 6. We did Beethoven's 9th. We did Mozart's symphonies. We've done Handel's Messiah. I mean, this was an opportunity now for me to be completely surrounded by others that looked like me in our various cities, you know, New York City, Houston, Los Angeles. But for that weekend, we would all come together to make some outstanding music. And, you know, even after I graduated, I would come back to the festival to perform, to bring my students to perform. They had an opportunity to do a side-by-side, just a life-changing experience, you know?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, and this, as you're talking about that and talking about the lack of representation when it comes into orchestras, and also talking earlier about your artistic, your interpretation of music as well. So I'm this is kind of a larger question of sorts, but are orchestras missing something by not having representation in the sense that they're not getting the Black experience, or or people of would it only add to the orchestras to have that type of representation from an artistic standpoint?
Yeah, that's an outstanding question. And the first thing that comes to mind, again, in my research and my scholarship, I found out that the very first orchestra in the United States was an orchestra called the Negro Philharmonic Society from 1830 in New Orleans. That was the first organized orchestra.
Okay.
It was all Black. And I found out that there were Black orchestras all throughout, you know, the United States, performing ensembles. Unfortunately, now what has happened is that the underrepresentation of Black people in classical music. Now, you know, every genre, you know, there's more or less, of course, genres like hip hop, R&B, of course, right?
Right.
I think, you know, Beyonce, she has the number one slot in country music right now, which
you know, I think if she took up classical music,
right,
she'd probably have some
number ones in that too, right? But I think that classical music would do a lot by having more Black representation. My professor at University of Rochester, Dr. Kim Kowalki, said something that struck my attention back then, and he said in 1914 classical music died. And he said what saved it was jazz. He said that in 1914, during World War One, the Black soldiers that went to Europe brought their jazz records with them. And when composers like Darius Milhaud and other composers heard jazz, they began writing jazz into their symphonies. And even here in the United States, you know, George Gershwin. And it was that jazz element that introduced an entirely new audience to classical music. And so, you know, that same opportunity, I think, is here today, not just with jazz, but with, you know, some orchestras are incorporating, you know, hip hop, R&B. You know, of course, we have a pops division of the Philharmonic, which is an outstanding, you know, experience, but also players, musicians. For a Black child to be able to go to the Philharmonic and see someone on the stage that looks like them, you know, playing, but also executing in a virtuosic way, I think that would have miles of impact into the future. I think it's a totally untapped target audience.
Sure.
That orchestras all over the country would benefit by having the presence of Black people on the stage. And I think that, you know, that's what we're trying to do with Muhammad's School of Music, with the other artists like myself in our various, you know, cities and regions where we're out performing and sharing the music that we love, Mozart, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, you know, but playing it in our way, in our, you know, with our interpretation. I think it gives an entirely new opportunity for classical music to have a resurgence.
So let's maybe just now switch gears a little bit. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about classical music, and I wouldn't mind getting back to it before the end of our conversation here with Henry Muhammad. But you also, just to put this in perspective, when Stevie Wonder was here with his Songs in the Key of Life tour, you performed with him as well.
Yeah, so Stevie Wonder, one of the greatest artists of our time. You know,
absolutely.
As we talk about Beethoven, Mozart, the name of Stevie Wonder will live on in the same way. And Stevie Wonder, of all the hits, I mean, the countless albums, you can name any album, any genre, time period, from even his youth up until today, you know, still writing music. But that particular album, the Songs in the Key of Life album, which came out in September 1976, a month before I was born, for the 40th anniversary of that album, Stevie Wonder went on a tour. And it was a nationwide tour. And I would notice as I was, you know, on social media and all, as I mentioned, my colleagues in Black classical musician from around the country, they were posting photos where they perform with Stevie Wonder, right? And as I shared, you know, there might be one or two of us in a particular city. And so that one or two were on the stage with Stevie Wonder.
Mm.
As Stevie Wonder had an orchestra that performed on that tour, right? And so I wondered, you know, when he comes to Buffalo, you know, I would love to be able to perform with Stevie Wonder.
Sure.
And lo and behold, I got a phone call asking me if I would like to perform as part of that tour. And so, you know, one of the things about Stevie Wonder that I admire is that Stevie Wonder and his albums always work trying to have a classical element. And it's, if you listen to some of his albums, there's always some classical influenced piece that is on the album. And so on that particular album, there are a couple songs. Village Ghetto Land is one of them. If It's Magic is another song that is really classically influenced. Mm. And so Stevie Wonder was on the tour. And once again, actually, as I've been talking about, even in that orchestra, I was the only Black person in that orchestra.
Wow.
Which was made up of local musicians, members of the Philharmonic, and other musicians. And so, you know, once again, being able to represent our people, Black people, and that stage with one of the greatest artists of all time was just a lifetime experience, you
sure.
know. And I'm thankful for the opportunity. I'm thankful for the musicians that reached out to me that said, you know, who can we get to play in the orchestra? And they called Henri Mohammed. I was just, you know, thrilled, honored, and I'll take that with me forever, you know?
Of course, and deservedly so. I'm always curious about these tours that do come through, and they'll mm-hmm. bring in local soloists, or
right.
Which is great, of course. Mm-hmm. How much time do you actually have to rehearse and be ready for that?
You know, so part of the preparation is just your basic musical ability. So as a violinist, a classically trained violinist and collegiate trained, and, you know, I'm able to read music, which is fundamental. You know, I encourage all my students to learn to read sheet music because that's like learning to read out of a book.
I
mean, you know, some people are functionally illiterate and they can function in society without being able to read. But if you can read, it makes life a whole lot better. The same thing with music, right? There's also the aspect of being able to play, you know, by ear and play, you know, knowing how to improvise and create music on the spot. So walking into the rehearsal, you know, with those two aspects, you know, working side by side, you know, myself, the other musicians that, you know, the other local musicians that were, you know, contracted, you know, we had, you know, a few hours rehearsal as an ensemble. We had an opportunity to do a sound check rehearsal with Mr. Stevie Wonder on the stage.
Mm.
And then we got on the stage and for the concert, we did it. And also I will say, because I love the album, you know, the Songs in the Key of Life album is on rotation on my playlist.
Okay.
So, you know, not just being able to read the music, but being able to know the songs and sing the songs and experience the music in a live way, you know, helps, because then the music becomes a part of you. And it's like, I can't believe I'm playing it with Stevie Wonder. Right. But, you know, being prepared, being, you know, ready to, you know, perform. And, you know, one of my former teachers, Charles Veal, who passed away, but Mr. Veal was an outstanding composer, violinist, and conductor. And in his catalog, when you listen to the music of, say, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you hear the string arrangements, like on the song Fantasy, he was the one that wrote those string arrangements and recorded them. And so he was my coach, and he told me as we were preparing, he was teaching me the Sanson Violin Concerto. He said, you know, you have to be ready to get that phone call and have the concerto ready to go on stage 3 or 4 days later. Mm. So I always keep that in mind that, you know, that I want to have my repertoire, my technicality always, you know, on point. So that if I get a phone call from Stevie Wonder, and you know, I could be on a plane out to L.A. to take care of whatever it is that he wants me to take care of.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. That's now. That's amazing stuff, for sure. I want to maybe switch gears just a little bit and talk about your work inside Buffalo Public Schools.
Yes.
Because this is important. And we've also heard at times that in some of the schools, there's not a lot of musical opportunities for kids to learn music. How important is it for these classrooms, for these schools to have opportunities to learn music?
I think as a alumni of Buffalo Public Schools, as a teacher, as a parent, as a professional musician, I think every child should have the opportunity to experience a musical instrument. I think that it gives an exceptional edge to and complement to their education. And so, you know, I bringing my gift back into the same classrooms that I went into. As I mentioned, I'm an alumni of performing arts. I'm taught at performing arts. I'm an alumni of the Frederick Law Olmsted School. I've taught in Olmsted. You know, going into the schools and interacting with its children that are kind of like me growing up, you know, and giving them the gift that my parents gave me that shaped my whole life, giving that to them, and seeing, you know, how it impacts not just their musical artistic education, but it impacts every other aspect of their education, including math and reading and analytical thinking and critical reasoning and creativity, of course, not just creativity in music, but in writing and all and all of that. And so it's important. And I think that, you know, every educational plan should have that aspect, and in particular, musical instruments. You know, so because I love the violin, is one of the only instruments that can be constructed in what's called fractional sizes. And so they make violins. Of course, if I play on a full size violin, they make violins as small as my hand. You know, real strings, real bow, real instrument, right? That I can start my 2, 3, 4 year olds on. Right?
Oh, wow.
And
right.
So I have 2, 3, 4 year olds who are growing up now studying the violin, you know, their entire life. Of course, my own personal children have started the violin when they were 2 and 3. Right now, my eldest daughter is on a full violin scholarship at Roosevelt University in Chicago.
Oh, my. Congratulations to you and her.
Thank you. You know, so that, you know, I think giving your child that experience, you know, that can't be, you know, duplicated. Of course, I tell everyone, it's never too late to start the violin. If you're
really
young, old, adult, child, retired, it's never too late. But to
what if you're just generally tone deaf? Maybe not.
I think everyone has an opportunity,
okay.
You know. But imagine being able to grow up with the violin, grow up with classical music, grow up with experiencing art, not art, but just your overall outlook on life and experience that from through that lens. I think that is the gift that we can give our children. And as I shared, I have students that have gone on into every field of endeavor, not just, of course, music or art, but into ballet, into law enforcement, into medicine, into law, into, you know, politics. And the violin and that experience of music has always been a positive impact in their whatever it is that they go into.
But unfortunately, it does seem like when, you know, budgets come around at schools,
right,
music is right there near the top of the things that that often get taken away. Do you find a frustration in trying to, I mean, the message you just shared with me right there, I think shares what's behind music for sure and the value of it. But is that a frustrating element for you when it comes to those kind of conversations?
You know, it is. And unfortunately, I've been at a number of schools where the programs have been cut, you know, and that's part of the reason that Muhammad School of Music is now celebrating 25 years, because, you know, we, you know, we believe that this is an experience that our children should have, that both the students but their families, you know, make the sacrifice and financial, but the commitment of time to give their children something of value that really is, you know, is really priceless. And so, my parents gave me, and I can't calculate the amount of money that they've spent on lessons, instruments, trips back and forth to lessons. But now when I called my dad after Stevie Wonder, you know, to tell my dad, you know, I sent him a little video clip, right? And, you know, and then, of course, all the other creative opportunities, things that I've done,
sure,
that parents look back and say, this is what, you know, all of my sacrifice has done. And now for me as a parent, you know, my daughter, you know, the full scholarship, she did a performance the other day, and I saw it on social media, right? And I was just, you know, this is my daughter. And I'm the parent, and I'm thinking about all the lessons and the violins, the instruments and whatnot. And now she's a performing artist. She's also a teacher in Chicago. She's still in her university studies,
sure,
but she's teaching now. And so, you know, that I believe is the most priceless gift that we can give our children, which is cultivation.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, you know, Muhammad School of Music, independent of whatever the school program might be doing, is in our community. We're here, and, you know, we open up the door for everyone to be able to come and take advantage of this, and give it to your children. You know, give them something that's going to last their entire lives.
A couple of questions, maybe a little on the lighter side of things, but as you were talking about, purchasing instruments or renting instruments for a child so they can learn, the Stradivarius violins that are worth all this money, are they worth it? Are they,
That's
in terms of
question.
Sound? I mean, is it really something there?
You know, I went on a search for a new instrument for this Beethoven violin concerto, and so in my search, I'm always studying the violin. So and I learned a lot about the instruments, particularly the legendary instruments of Stradivarius, Guarnerius, which I've had the opportunity to play some of those instruments. I played the violins of Stradivarius. I played the violins of Guarnerius, other names out there, Amati violins. And what I learned was that, you know, aside from some of the hype, you know, there is some hype around,
sure,
it. The Italian violins from Italy, Stradivarius Italian, Guarnerius Italian, seem to be a little more higher ranking, you know, than the violins from France. And there's some English violins, some Dutch violins, even though performance-wise they might outdo each other. But also, you know, these are instruments that are sometimes 200 and 300 years old, right? And so there's the antique value of,
sure,
the instrument. And then also what goes into it is the condition of the instrument. And so what I learned was that, you know, to have $1 million Stradivarius or a 10 or 15, $20 million, you know, Guarnerius, the condition of the instrument has to be, you know, on a certain level. So and almost flawless, which means no breaks, cracks, repairs, is in the $18 million, $20 million range. However, something might say it's a Stradivarius, but perhaps it could have had multiple repairs. It could, you know, there's parts of the violin. There's the scroll. There's the back. There's the face, the front. Mm-hmm. Those might not be original parts, right?
Okay.
So it's like saying I have a BMW, but it's a Toyota engine on the inside, right? It has the BMW logo on the hood, but not all the parts of BMW.
Right.
So that might bring, you know, the price down a little bit. Other things also go into it, like who played on the violin before.
Okay.
You know, and so some of the violins carry some notable names, right? So the violin that I played several violins looking for the one that I currently have, which is a violin by a French maker named Claude Augustin Mirmont, which is, that violin is maybe close to about 200 years old. It's an outstanding instrument. And I, you know, the voice, the depth of the instrument, the soul of the instrument, I think is really speaking to this Beethoven violin concerto that I'm putting together. There is a story behind the violin. Mirmont was a French composer who, but violin maker, luthier, they call them. But for about 10 years, he actually came to New York. And he lived in New York, from Paris to New York for 10 years. And the instruments that he made in New York during his residency over here on the East Coast are exceptional instruments compared to the ones that he built back in France. And so I was able to acquire one of his violins for this Beethoven Violin Concerto performance. And it's an outstanding instrument right now. My daughter plays on an Italian violin by a modern Italian maker named Giorgio Grisalis, who is in the same city that Stradivarius built violins. And in fact, Maestro Grisalis is the president of the Stradivarius Society of Cremona, Italy. And so her violin that I acquired for her, you know, it's a new violin that he built, you know, at my request and under my, you know, specifications. And so she's playing on it. She's been playing on it for about a year now. And so the violin already sounds, you know, even more mature now, you know. So imagine a 300-year-old Stradivarius, how much depth and soul is in that instrument. And I will admit, when I played, you know, the violins of Guarnerius and Stradivarius, I could feel 300 years old of violin. And in fact, I had dreams about one particular violin, the Guarneri del Gesu, which they called the Folinari violin, built in 1725. I had dreams about that violin.
Oh my goodness.
For months afterwards. I don't know where that violin is now, but if it ever makes its way back to Bein and Fushi in Chicago, which is where I played that violin, I might have to go pay a visit to that violin.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Hey, people. I'm Corey, and this is Compact Civics. One thing about me, I love voting. Voting for pizza over wings, going to this movie or that. But what I love most is casting my vote in an election.
What's one vote when so many people
vote? My
vote
doesn't really count. Can one vote really make a difference?
All right. I hear your doubts, but yes, it really can. Check this out. In 2002, a police officer in Washington State was running for the primary in the State House of Representatives. Out of nearly 12,000 votes, he came up one vote short. And here's the kicker. A fellow officer and friend, possibly former friend, forgot to mail in his ballot and left it sitting on his kitchen counter next to his water bill and half-eaten toast. Also in 2002, Esmeralda County in Nevada held an election for commissioner. It ended in a tie. And in the most Nevada thing ever, the tie was broken by having the candidates pick the highest card from a deck of playing cards. And right here in Western New York, the town supervisor election in Barry in Orleans County came down to a narrow 5-vote difference. There are more than 2,000 people in Barry, and only 600 people voted. So you see, one is not the loneliest number. It can be one of the most powerful numbers when it comes to our democracy.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
Hey, educators, you've been asking for it, and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills, such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history and following the drinking gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
We're with Henry Muhammad here on What's Next. Another thing, you mentioned how the songs in the Key of Life is on your playlist.
Yes.
What else is on your playlist?
So I, along with my classical music, I'm an avid fan of contemporary music, the music of Prince, Michael Jackson, Bob Marley. Again,
well, Bob Marley, yeah.
Stevie Wonder. Wow. You know, so Stevie Wonder's music, you know, the Songs of the Key of Life is 40 years old, which qualifies it as oldies but goodies. You know, so, but the music for us is just as fresh and new. You know, we perform at one of my Buffalo Public School programs, we performed, recorded, and did a music video to Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal. We did an original rendition. And, you know, I observed that when we experienced the music of Michael Jackson, even though that particular song, Smooth Criminal, is 30 years old, 1987, I think it came out, for the students who are, you know, pre-K, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade, it's like new.
Right.
It's like magic, right? And so, you know, artists, composers that have that gift, Beethoven, Mozart, Prince, Bob Marley, their music becomes timeless, you
right.
know. It doesn't have a shelf life because, you know, playing it today as it was or 40 years ago, it's still new and people are still listening to it and downloading it and, you know, and vinyl LPs. You know, I remember my dad having a vinyl LP player, record player, and learning him teaching me how to put. Back then, you know, when you studied Suzuki Violin School, which I studied, we had a vinyl LP that we had to listen to every day as part of our ear training. And so he taught me how to put the record on the record player. Don't scratch the record. Put the needle down. I'd have to sit there and listen to the violin record. But then when that finished, I would put on James Brown.
Mm.
I would put on, you know, Marvin Gaye, of course, Michael Jackson, Prince. And I was listening to all of this, you know, now eclectic music that is part of my approach. And so, you know, with the Beethoven, you know, one of the things that I learned about Beethoven was Beethoven really was like the Michael Jackson of his day. He was a mega superstar. They said that when he died at his funeral, 20,000 people came to his funeral.
Wow.
Lining the streets of Vienna. And so, you know, they were like the rock stars of their day, their personality, their dress code. I mean, Beethoven was known to be a very flashy dresser. He was known to be very, you know, influential with the ladies. He was very temperamental. He had a certain persona about him that could be similar to, you know, Prince, Michael Jackson, their, you know, the way they, you know, their impact on the world. I read something that said that when Beethoven would perform, his music at the time was so, you know, what's the word? Powerful. Mm. That the critic wrote that women would faint and men would weep listening
wow.
to Beethoven. Now, to me, that sounds like the Michael Jackson concert where people are passing out in the front row,
right?
But this was Beethoven, you know, women fainting and men crying, listening to his music because, you know, they were like that then. And we have artists like that today. And so I try to bring that spirit into my interpretation of his music, even though I'm playing the notes that he wrote 200 years ago, that attitude, you know, has to be there. The attitude of Beethoven. And of course, you know, Mozart was very similar and Tchaikovsky and composers like that. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're winding down our minutes here with Henry Muhammad and the 25th anniversary. Where have there been times during this journey of learning where you're like, I can't do this?
You know, I have some good days where I feel like I'm on it, and there's some days when Beethoven kicks my butt, you know. And from the grave, he's still, you know, intimidating artists. I know sometimes I go out and perform his works with violin and piano, and I've had some pianists back out at the last minute because to play his piano works are just as challenging as the violin works. You know, he just wrote something that's tremendously, you know, uncompromising, and you know, it takes some courage to approach his music. But he, you know, that's the majesty of him. And as I shared, this is the 200th year of his Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the masterpiece that the Philharmonic will present on May 11th and 12th. And if you've ever experienced that piece, I both performed it and I conducted it. I conducted the Philharmonic for Muhammad School of Music's 10th anniversary. We did a side-by-side with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra. And for the finale, I conducted the orchestra on Beethoven's Ninth Symphony,
wow.
that fourth movement. And to have the orchestra, the Philharmonic, and the chorus, and of course my violin students played along, to experience that masterpiece in that way, to have the music all around you, it was just, again, it's just life-changing experience. And so, you know, Beethoven is legendary. He will live on forever.
And hopefully for many more years to come, there'll be more anniversaries of the Muhammad School of Music. It's
Absolutely.
25th anniversary. Henry Muhammad, boy, what a great conversation. And I appreciate you joining us on What's Next.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Thank you for joining us for What's Next here on WBFO. And we now have for you violinist Henri Star Mohammed playing the beautiful Meditation from Jules Massenet's opera Thaïs.